Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Becky Ellis. Now, Becky Ellis is a Timberwolf pup, the daughter of a highly decorated World War II combat sergeant. She is a veteran of a war fought at home. She earned a BA in English Literature at UC Berkeley and has over 20 years of experience in the publishing industry. She teaches writing in Portland, Oregon, where she lives, plays, and has raised three daughters. Little Avalanches is her debut memoir. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Becky.
Thank you so much, Monica. I'm so happy to be here. I appreciate you having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So tell us about the title of this, Little Avalanches.
Yes, the title.
Yeah.
The title started as just a phrase in the book. It's a metaphor for all the little traumas that happen in life. And when I was young, at one point, I lived in the desert outside of Rancho Mirage with my mother and brother. And my mother, I was a latchkey kid, and my mom worked during the day and went to school in the evening. So I would go up into the desert behind our house when I was about 6 years old, and I would start these little avalanches. And I wrote about that in the book, and the scene became, you know, that phrase was in the scene, and then it rose to a chapter title, and my agent said, that's an amazing title for the book. So it became the book's title.
So did you have other titles that you were considering?
I did. The title I was considering first was The Listening Post.
Which is also the title of a section of the book, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Correct.
So this memoir isn't just your memoir. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how the book is structured?
Yes, I would love to talk about that. The structure was really kind of difficult to come up with. It wasn't always structured this way, only in its last draft. And as many memoirs happen, I had many, many drafts of this book, more than I can count, to tell you the truth. And I'm talking about dozens, not a few. So the structure used to be braided together of my story of childhood, my father's story of World War II combat, and then the conversation we had at the end of his life when he turned 89 and came to visit and asked if I had any issues to clear up. And those were all braided together at one point. And the problem with the story at that time was that it was compelling and it read fine and the reader could track, but there weren't enough countervailing forces. I think that's because the reader knew what happened before it happened. And although it's not set up in chronological order, I started at one point with the grown woman's story of picking my father up at the airport. That was the opening chapter. And now that's the beginning of part three. And what happens now is we start right off in childhood with the story as I experienced it in my life was I was a child and had an experience and didn't have any idea what my father had been through because he wouldn't talk about it. And then I put his story in once I learned about it. And then I offered the reader our year-long conversation for part three.
So the drawback, maybe not drawback, but one of the results of this is that if you start reading the first part, you're thinking, man, her dad was a piece of work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That's how I experienced life. And that is how most people experienced my father, because he didn't talk about the war like most veterans, and he didn't talk about his trauma. He just tried to endure it and tried to live with it and cope with it the best he could.
You know, it's interesting because we have a lot of awareness of PTSD in veterans today from the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War. there was a lot of, I think, talk about shell shock in World War One, and we sort of knew that soldiers from World War One were sometimes, it wasn't called PTSD, it was called shell shock, but there was an awareness of it. But World War Two, there wasn't so much, was there? People didn't talk about it.
Right, because it was a very glorified war. Everyone thought they were fighting a great evil, and so soldiers were, you know, they were heroes and they were glorified, and it was a war that was won. And they talked about battle fatigue a little bit, but there really wasn't support or help for veterans coming home from World War II.
Right.
And PTSD did not enter the DSM as a diagnosis until 1980.
Wow.
Which is stunning to me. Yes. Long after Vietnam. Right.
Wow.
And it was because of Vietnam, I think, that people started studying the impact of war trauma more closely.
So do you think if your father had been able, willing, or, you know, had therapy in a sense, or an ability to talk about this earlier, that it would have made a difference for him?
You know, it kind of depends on the day you ask me that, to be honest, because it's a question that I feel it's a great question. And I think we all want to know that. We all want to know how to heal from this. And my father did seek help. He was an alcoholic until I was 12, and then he stopped drinking, and he did get better. When he stopped drinking, he was better. But was he healed? He was not healed. And I just spoke with a veteran a couple days ago who told me he's had tons of therapy and been through so much recovery and healing. And he said his PTSD is getting worse with age. He's in his 70s. And people have asked me if I think my father, if talking helped. I do think that it helped. Research shows that talking and about our experiences, our traumatic experiences, helps us normalize them, helps us integrate them into our lives. But I believe that my father carried his trauma and his guilt to his last breath. And I was with him when he took that last breath. And I think that his soul was so wounded that it was something that he could never really escape.
When I read about the things that you went through as a child, and of course, at some point you fled from your father, but you always came back, sometimes because you didn't have a choice, and sometimes by choice. So in a way, it almost surprised me that as he, you know, when he was coming to visit your family in his 80s, that you seemed so accepting of him then, that you didn't, you know, that you had seemed to have forgiven him.
Right. So that there's so much to say about that, because like all little girls and young women and grown women, I wanted my dad to love me. I think we always want our dad to love us. And while I resisted my father and I feared him as a child, I revered him also. And I always felt that there was something bigger than him and bigger than me. I knew he'd been in the war, even though he wouldn't talk about it, because these little bits and pieces that he'd spool out when he had a lot to drink when I was a child. And I didn't give him a pass because of it. I always tried to hold him accountable, but I knew there was something else. And I always wanted to understand him because I wanted to understand myself. I think on an unconscious level, I wanted to know what happened because I knew that it shaped my life. At some point in my childhood, it dawned on me that other kids had different childhoods than I did. Other fathers weren't like mine. And I knew there was a reason for that, because my dad could be very loving and very kind as well, but he was also very dangerous.
But he was actually pretty attentive in a way to you and your brother and your half-sister. Well, mainly you and your brother. It sounds like from the book that you know, he even when you didn't want to go visit him anymore, he, as a you know, adolescent, he insisted. He made it happen. Why do you think that is?
I asked my dad about that when we talked about the war. I started to see things in his war experience that I made connections to my childhood. And one of the things I asked him was, why did you fight so hard to keep Martin and I? Martin is my bigger brother. And I think that my father had a lot of regret about walking away from his first three children. He had three children with his first wife, and he left one day and he didn't turn back. And he was a well-respected surgeon in town. He was a well-respected father, community member, and he picked up and left. And he moved out to Las Vegas, where my mother followed him. She was a nurse in the hospital where he worked. And he moved to Las Vegas because he knew he could get a divorce in Las Vegas in a couple weeks without any, in Nevada. They didn't move to Vegas. They moved to Nevada without any,
No fault.
Yeah. No fault. Right. Yeah. So I always was afraid my father would abandon me too. If I did something wrong or pushed him too far, I lived with that my whole life that, oh, I know Dad can walk away. And I wanted that sometimes, you know, but mostly in my heart, I did not want that. None of us want to be abandoned by our parents, especially when we're small. And, I think that he regretted walking away from those first three children, and I don't think he was going to make that mistake again. I think that's why he fought so hard.
Did he ever reconnect with them?
His oldest son, he did reconnect with. His oldest son, who was also carried his name, sought my father out once he got to college. Mm. And he came and looked for my father, and he visited, and I met him when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I thought it was amazing. He looked so much like my father, just a younger version. And I thought he was really fun because he was 20 years old. And it was a really intense visit, though. I could tell there was something big that they were reckoning with.
And did he maintain that relationship? Or
no.
No.
He did not.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do those half siblings know about your book?
Yes. One of them has passed away, and the other two do know about my book, and they are reading it. I think it's hard. I think it's a hard read for them.
I'm sure.
That's the input that I've received.
Yeah.
And I can feel that compassion. If I were abandoned as a child, I think it would be very hard for me to read about my father from one of his other children.
Yeah, yeah.
With great compassion for that.
Did you have, you know, knowing that that could or would be likely to happen, did that affect you at all as you were writing?
No, I really tried to write without my family in mind, I guess. That's how memoir, I think, can become the most true, is to start writing really without a reader in mind to get to the heart and the truth of what the memoirist is trying to say. And then, of course, as the book was shaped, I edited and wrote especially with the reader in mind. My father's section, the center of the book, is his war story on the combat field. And that started as 300 pages when he told me his story, and I just wrote it out as he told it. And it is now about 30, 32 pages. It's condensed down like a fine balsamic vinegar. And I did that with the reader in mind, because the reader can only take so much of that.
Yeah, yeah. Your other siblings that you write about in the book, did you get there sort of okay on what you wrote about them before publication or not?
Yes. I did. Okay. And it, Martin and Shayna, my two siblings that I'm very close with, are very important people in my life. I'm not sure I would have survived my childhood without them, or maybe not my adulthood either. They steady me and they make me realize that, yes, this did happen. Because it's easy to wonder, did that really happen? Yeah, it did happen. And they were with me in it. And I wanted them to be okay with it. So they read a draft towards the end. I did not put them through all of the drafts of the book. It was toward the end when I said, I'd like you to read this. And my sister read it very quickly, and she said she had to sleep for 7 hours afterwards. It exhausted her to read it, and she had a really good cry. And my brother read it very slowly. He's a very meticulous person. He works in computer science, and he read it slowly because he wanted to have his own memories as he was reading it. So he told me that he would start a chapter. So one chapter, for example, is about learning to water ski. And he said he realized, okay, this is what the chapter is about. He put it down and he sat with it for a few days to remember himself what that experience was like. And then he picked it up and read it. And after finishing it, he sent me an entire page of corrections in 8-point font. And they were things like, Dad's knives didn't have brown handles. They were black. And they were this exact brand. And he sent me a link to the brand of the carving knives that my father had in the kitchen. And, you know, details about his guns, which my brother knew more about than me. And one thing he said was, Mom's Mustang was not pale yellow. It was white. And I said, no, I'm sure it was pale yellow. He said, well, I'm sure it was white. And like we did most times in childhood, I said, well, I'm going to get Mom to settle this. So I called our mom and I asked her, was your Mustang white or yellow? And she said, oh, Becky, dear, your brother's right. It was white, which is something I heard all the time in my childhood. Oh, Becky, dear, your brother is right. But I left it as pale yellow because I said to her, well, I don't think you ever washed the thing. So I think it was just so grimy that it looked yellow. So I'm leaving it as yellow.
Oh, that's cute. So were there any, did he make any substantive changes?
Like, no.
No. So his memories really did coincide with yours pretty closely.
He had different memories also. Some of the things when he had his own experience of the events. The events, yes, but his experience of the events was very different than mine. My father treated my brother and I differently. And I think you feel that when reading the book, is there are different expectations put on my brother, even though he was 15 months older than me. He was 7 when I was 6, and he had much more responsibility than I did. And so his experience of the events was different. And I tried really hard to write about my experience from my point of view.
Yeah, I kind of got the feeling like your brother may have always felt like he was disappointing your dad in some way.
I think that's possible. I know my brother was afraid of my father, and probably until he had his own children. Mm-hmm. And my brother passed my father in height when he was about 17. And my father never, one of the things he did not do was he never spanked us or hit us or physically hurt us himself.
Even though he did his wives.
Possibly.
Possibly.
I never saw him do that, but I believe that probably happened. Yeah. But he never laid a hand on us. And he always said, I'm not going to do that because I know you kids are going to be bigger than me someday. And he would joke and laugh about it. But I believed he didn't want to hurt us. I don't think it was ever his intention to hurt us. I think he wanted us to be tough as old nails and really strong and prepared. Prepared for what? I never knew. Mm. Not as a child.
Wow.
But you know why he made me get my teeth drilled without Novocaine? I think he wanted me to be tough. I think he wanted me to be able to handle the battlefield, really, handle what happened to him on the battlefield.
Now, you had a pretty strong influence with your mother that probably counterbalanced some of what was going on with your dad. And I mean, you don't write that much about your mother, but it seems like, you know, she was pretty steady influence.
She was very steady and very stable.
Yeah.
And I write about her and experiences with her. And she was also controlled by my father, even though she was divorced by him. And I made a real effort in the book to show the constraints that women had in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Because they were more constrained than women are now.
Yeah, the fact that he kept taking her back to court for anything.
Right.
She really couldn't afford it to
right.
go. And yeah, how difficult. And yet she never talked to you. She never told you about that. She didn't try and turn you against your father, which is pretty
she
amazing.
She did not.
That's a pretty...
It's amazing. I admire her for that. Because
yeah.
I was challenged as a mother with that. When I would be upset with my husband, I would want to just blurt it out and say, well, kids, this is why we're not getting a dog or whatever. And I really admire my mother for her ability to not say bad things about my father.
Yeah, no kidding. So
yes.
the person that ends up, or that from your way that you write about it, that you almost feel sorriest for is Sheena, who didn't have that either.
Right.
Yeah.
She did not have that either.
Yeah.
Her mom left when she was about 6 years old and moved to Hawaii. And Shayna was left with my father and
wow.
his next wife. And I believe she had it the toughest because she didn't have that stabilizing force. My brother Martin and I always wanted to take Shayna home with us. We wanted her to come live with us. I write about that in the book a little bit. But,
yes,
you know,
yeah.
I think I write one scene about it. But it was a constant. We wanted to take her home every time, every other weekend when we visited.
Did you ever talk to your mother about it?
I think so. I think I asked, can Shayna come live with us? And my mother's response was, your father would never allow that,
yeah.
which is true.
Right.
Shayna did visit us from time to time. She knew my mom, and she was able to come do fun things with us
Aww.
On occasion.
Yeah.
yeah.
So as you know, you're an adult, your father's coming to visit you. He's 89 years old, and he finally, like, gives you an opening to ask about the past. What do you think was going through his mind? Why did he do that after all those years?
Well, I think he wanted me to say, he came and he asked if we had any issues to clear up. And I think he wanted me to say, of course not. Like, we're great. I love you. Everything's perfect. Everything's wonderful. I had built this beautiful life that was carefully curated with granite countertops and fun birthday parties and great vacations. And I think he wanted me to say, look around. Everything's great. But that life that looked beautiful from the outside felt like I was holding it together with scotch tape. And every time he came to visit, I felt like that tape was peeling back. And I felt the foundation of my life just falling apart when he visited. And I ultimately realized I had not escaped my childhood with this life I built. I was repeating it because I was hiding. And that's why I asked about the war, because I felt like everything that happened in my childhood and I felt like that, it might not be true, but I felt like everything that happened in my childhood was a result of his trauma, from his war trauma, his combat trauma. Yeah. He was on the battlefield for 172 days and his unit, the 104th Infantry Division, they had the most days of consecutive battle than any other infantry division in World War II. They made it 195 days of continuous battle. And my father was on the battlefield for over 6 weeks without changing his clothes or taking a shower or sleeping in a bed or having a hot meal or brushing his teeth or any of that. And his unit had a, he was a rifleman, and the rifleman had a very high casualty rate, and his unit had a 300% casualty rate. So he saw men die constantly. And men be replaced constantly. Kids, they were 17, kids, yeah. 18, 19. Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Becky Ellis, author of Little Avalanches. Becky, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
I would love to. I would love to read from two sections.
Perfect.
And the first section is from part one, and it's about my childhood to give you a sense of what that was like. And I'm going to read part of the chapter. I'm going to skip a backflash. And the only thing that you need to know is that I was born on my father's birthday, and this wasn't by chance or nature. My father was a doctor, and he wanted me to be born on his birthday. And it was close to my mother's due date. So he induced her labor on his birthday so I could be born on his birthday. He was a bit controlling, my dad. So this chapter is called The Birthday Girl. Before the ink was dry on the custody agreement, my big brother Martin and I were off to visit my father for 6 weeks. It was the summer of my sixth birthday. I had just finished kindergarten the week before and still had all my baby teeth and wore footy pajamas at night. My father's mahogany boat, the Bomber, idled in a narrow slough on the Sacramento Delta, deep in California's Central Valley. Steep levees rose up on both sides, thick with thorn blackberry bushes, and tules clustered in shallow bays, their grassy tops swinging side to side. My father sat in the captain's chair, bare except for a tiny Speedo swimsuit. His hand was fisted around a cold beer, and his wrist guided the wheel. Judy lounged beside him, topless and tanned. They were married now, and her belly was beginning to bump out with my little sister Shayna inside. Martin was in the back, his arm straight and stiff above his head with the orange observer's flag. I stood on the back seat, a neon orange life vest knocked against my jaw and the ski rope stiff handle clutched in my hands. "I don't want to do this," I said. "Nonsense," my father said over the rumbling engine. "It's as easy as riding a trike." He called it fun and a privilege, but I'd been dreading this day for a whole year since I watched Martin get dragged behind the boat on his sixth birthday. Water drained from his nose for hours, and his eyes were red for days from the burn of muddy Delta water. I had hoped my father would forget what he called a family tradition that only began with my brother, or I hoped he would give me a pass. I was his fifth child, third girl, a daughter from his second wife, but I was also his birthday girl, born on his 41st birthday. At 6 years old, I could not see our shared birthday as anything but special. Mine was a birthday he always remembered, the only one he always celebrated. I was the one he pulled onto his lap year after year before a blazing inferno, wax dripping into buttercream. I couldn't imagine he would force me into the water on our day. I wanted a birthday cake, a tower of presents, and a parachute of balloons for my birthday. My father wanted to pull me behind the Bomber for his. "Go on, get in," he said. His voice was steady and firm, and his eyes held mine for a moment longer than usual, a sign he was teaching me a lesson. A small stick drifted in the swift current and disappeared under the boat. "But I don't want to," I said again. "You're wasting gas," my father said, his voice picking up energy. I slid off the side of the boat into cool, murky water. Judy handed my father's old wooden trick skis to me. I wrestled them on one at a time, shoving my feet into the tight rubber boots. "Raise the flag higher," my father said to Martin. "You don't want your sister to get run over by an idiot drunk or have her legs chopped off by a propeller." Then he steered away from me. I pulled my legs up quick, knees tight against my chin. The thrum of the engine faded. A line of bubbles rose in its wake. Slack came out of the rope, pulling me forward through the water. "Just hang on and stand up," my father hollered. I maneuvered the tips of my skis out of the water like my father had told Martin to do the year before, and my father gunned the bomber's engine. My body dragged hard against the water, and it felt as though I was being pulled through cement. The rubber handle snapped out of my hands, tearing at my fingers. My father cut the engine and turned tight on the boat's tail, cruising toward me. "Grab a hold of the rope and try again," he called over the side. The boat circled me, yellow rope trailing like a snake. I tried again. Water pushed up my nose with the force of a fire hose. It filled my ears and eyes, tore at my belly button, and shoved into every hollow part of my body. And again, I pitched face first into the river. And again. "Just stand up," my father said over and over, as if the mechanics would suddenly become clear to me by repeating them. I heard the howl of another engine and had visions of the current pulling my small body away from the boat and away from the observer's flag held high. "I can't do it," I called out to my father. I wanted him to pull up alongside me, reach for the tips of my skis, and pull me into the boat. I wanted him to wrap a sun-warm towel around me and tell me I could try again next year. I wanted him to say, "That's my birthday, girl. Good try," and slap me on the back. But the bomber circled me again, and my father, his back stiff and straight, idled away as if I hadn't spoken. Martin lifted the flag a little higher. "You'll get it this time, Beckaboo," Judy cheered. But I didn't get it that time or the next, and began to cry. "I hate this," I hollered. "I quit." My father circled again, engine growling, water churning. This time, he slowed to an idle and leaned over the boat. "I don't ever want to hear you say I quit again," he said. His voice was stern and his eyes hard. "If you give up, you're dead." Then he glanced at the instrument panel on the dash. "I just filled her up with gas, and I'll waste the whole fucking tank if that's what it takes to get your pussy ass out of the water." My spirit sank. Another child might have become hysterical, ripped off her life jacket, thrashed around in the water, or let her skis float away. But I wanted my father to love me, and by then I knew that his love was something that had to be fought for day after day, year after year, as if being loved was an endless war to be won.
Okay. And that's Becky Ellis reading from Little Avalanches. Now, the other section that you wanted to read is from your father's telling of his experience in war.
Yes. And this is part two of the book. And it is written in journal format, day one to day 172. It's not every day. Many days are skipped, but it's written in chronological order. And this isn't the way his story came out when he was telling me. It's what I pieced together from.
So I'm curious about how you were able to do that. Did you have to go back and like research World War II battle history to figure out where he was, what he was talking about?
Yes, I wanted it to be accurate. My father's memory was incredible. He could remember such detail, but you know, he didn't talk about the detail of war really, but he could remember such detail of life, of things he'd read as a child or learned. He had memorized poems and this kind of thing.
When he was helping your daughter with her homework.
Yes. And that is why I put that in there, to establish my father as having good memory. That's why that little scene is in the book. he could remember the trade route on the Byzantine Empire.
That's amazing.
How does he know this? He just knew things. He was an incredibly intelligent man. And so I did research, and he also gave me the regimental movement of the 415th Infantry Division, or the 415th Regiment. It was the 104th Infantry. So his regiment had its own kind of day by day, hour by hour battle detail, and a lot of it was missing. It's not super clear because the battle was chaotic. At one point I said to my dad, none of this makes any sense. He said, Becky dear, nothing made any sense. And I could tell by reading this regimental directory that it was chaos. They didn't know where one unit was at one time or another. And so I did piece it together the best it could be pieced together. And this book is not a lesson in history. I feel like it's a study in humanity, but I did want it to be accurate. So I would like to read day 2 through day 5. It's only about 3 minutes. And this would be October 16th, 1944. And it's written in my father's voice. Day 2. Day 2. We were singing, laughing, smoking. News from the front was dismal. We all knew we were going to die because we were in the infantry, but we were kids and we were happy. We didn't know what dying in combat was like, and it was a beautiful country. Scattered buildings stood in open meadows, a barn here, a home there, wide open turnip fields as far as we could see. Manicured hedgerows surrounded little farms. Dirt roads zigzagged along. Day 3. We crossed into Belgium and couldn't step a toe off the roads. There were landmines tucked beneath turnip piles, booby traps tangled inside clipped bushes, and the ditches that lined the roads were filled with 4 feet of cold, muddy water and had been set with explosives. Total silence was enforced. No smoking, no talking, no littering. We couldn't leave a scrap behind. The entire division, 6,000 men, could have been tracked down and wiped out if a gum wrapper was tossed into a ditch. At night, we found little patches of dirt and dug in, hoping to God our trench shovels didn't slam into a mine. It wasn't dirt, more like swampland that filled around us, cold mud soaking through our uniforms. Day 4. We woke early and were ordered to leave our duffel bags behind. We took only equipment and ammunition we could carry on our backs. The 104th split up. One regiment went this way, another one that way, and combat teams like mine were sent ahead of everyone else. They called it spearheading. Day 5. Gunfire popped in the distance, and my unit moved along the dikes. We were walking next to this beautiful field. There was nobody around, no problem of any kind. And one of my guys, a kid named Bernard, sat down to rest on a little turnip pile. He grabbed a crisp turnip, rubbed it on his pants to clean off the mud, and then, in a split second, half his leg was gone. Shells rained around us, sending hot scraps of metal flying through the air, from tiny fragments I couldn't even see to huge pieces the size of car doors. I clawed at the ground with my hands and feet like a dog, trying to get as flat as I could. I saw a ditch at the side of the field, got up, ran like hell, and dove headfirst into the muddy trench. Soon guys ran toward me, and one by one, they dove in too. No one wanted to be the last one out, but some froze up and lay in the field, getting filled with holes. We weren't trained for this. We were timber wolves, night fighters, General Allen's secret weapon. He thought he'd surprise those krauts by sending us into combat in the middle of the night while Germany was sleeping, but all the training in the world couldn't have saved those boys. They were paralyzed by fear.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, and this is just the fifth day.
That's day 5.
Out
yes.
of 172?
Yes.
Wow.
Yep. It's heavy material, that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah. How long did it take you sitting down with your father to collect all of these stories? And did you just take notes by longhand, or did you record him too?
It took about a year to get most of his story, but then we talked about the deeper story for a few years, really until he died. And he passed away at 96, and he started talking to me at 89. So What was the second half of your question?
Did you write it all down in longhand or did you record him?
Oh, yeah. At first, I scribbled it down because I thought he was only going to tell me over lunch, over a tuna sandwich. And I was frantically writing things down, trying to understand. I had no idea how armies were divided or divisions made up. And then I started recording. After a few days, I thought, oh, I want to capture this. So I have hours and hours of recording of him talking about this.
Wow. Now, when you went to write, you said you started with 300 pages of this, just this part of the story, and then condensed it down to 30 some pages. Did you, were you actually writing it exactly as he said it initially? And then, of course, when you condensed it, you wouldn't have been, but.
Initially, a lot of it was in dialogue between my father and I. So a lot of it was the way he said it, but that was condensed down too, because my father told me stories as if his mind was fresh with trauma. They were very circular and some of them were scattered and didn't make sense. So I asked a lot of questions as he would tell me a story. And so they weren't exactly as he told them. The 300 pages were chronological. I wanted to make sure I got it all and that I got it all right. And I wanted him to read all of it and make sure that's what happened. And so I created those 300 pages as a draft for him to read and say, yes, this is correct.
So when he was telling you this, did he know you were going to write about it?
I didn't even know I was going to write about it when he was telling me this. So no.
But at some point he knew.
At some point. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. As soon as I thought, I got to write about this. I got to write about this and my childhood because it was so powerful to me. I started to see the connections. The two passages I read, I chose because there's a connection in them. My dad really believed if you quit, you're dead. And he didn't want his children to die. So he raised us to be relentless about everything that we did.
It is amazing how your mind can make, you know, can make you do things without you even understanding why, because of things that happened in the past.
And right.
Yeah, it's just, and when you can figure that out and make that connection.
Right. And, you know, I tried to raise my children so differently than I was raised. I wanted them to have such a stable, secure life. And as this story started unfolding and I started writing and really understanding my own behavior and what my behavior was from trauma, I realized how I was passing my trauma onto my children, too. And there's not a lot in the book about that, but there, I think, is enough to see that the kind of role model I was for my children, I was passing it down, the way I was hiding. I didn't have a voice. I didn't really speak out. I was passing that on.
Yeah, we do. Even with the best intentions of not doing it.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the awareness around it. And I wanted to understand myself. I wanted to be aware of what I was doing. And I think it's through that awareness is where the real healing has come for me. Mm-hmm. And it's still so hard. You know, I still make mistakes. My children are in their 20s now, and I still make mistakes with them. But now I can go back and say, okay, I know we talked about this yesterday, and I completely messed that up. I thought about it overnight, and I want to tell you this, you know, and they're more forgiving and they're more understanding and they hold me accountable. I have three girls and they are strong firecrackers themselves.
How was their relationship with your father? You do write about that in the book and it's some very sweet moments, but did they ever see that other side of him?
I think they saw pieces of it. I was really protective of them. And I would tell my dad, we're not going to talk about that. And I would, you know, usher them away. If I saw my dad was really unpredictable and I would usher them away. But I think that they saw he could be insensitive for sure. I remember my youngest daughter used to love yogurt. And he was sitting at the table with her one morning while she was having breakfast. And, you know, she was 7 or 8. And he said, that yogurt is full of bugs. You can't see them, but there are bugs. They're all bugs inside it. And he's right. There are probiotics in it. But that's the kind of thing he would do. And he wouldn't explain that they're probiotics and they're good bugs and they do this and that. He would just, he was a little bit alarmist, you know. And so, and that seems like such a benign thing. I told my oldest daughter when she was 12, she, at one point we were talking, we were standing in the bathroom and she said, you know, why, Grandpa seems nice. Why do you have such a hard time with him? And I just told her one tiny tidbit of my childhood. And she said, well, I don't even know why you talk to him then. Wow. And that's the thing, is we're so black and white sometimes in our thinking. And from a 12-year-old, that makes sense, right? 12-year-olds mm-hmm. are kind of black and white in their thinking. But I think even as adults, we're black and white in our thinking. And one of the biggest responses I've received from the book is how after reading the first part, I think you started our conversation with saying, one might despise my father. Those weren't your exact words, but right. That happens. But you get 3 pages into his story, and all of a sudden, you're flooded with empathy for this man that not 4 minutes ago you despised. And that was something that I really wanted to convey, is that if we understand another person's experience, we might change our position and we might have empathy. Because my father did reach a point in his story when I was flooded with empathy. It was a point that was so unimaginable to me. And at that moment, that was a real transition in my life, because I finally saw my father as someone separate from myself and as a man totally apart from me with his own life experience. And I used to want him to come to grandparents' day at my children's school and dress a certain way and say certain things and not embarrass me and not shame the kids. And when I finally saw him for who he was, all those expectations and desires fell away. And I could really see him and I could feel him for the man that he was, how wounded he had been. And that changed my life. And it allowed me to see other people that way. That's the moment when I finally really felt my humanity.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Becky Ellis, author of Little Avalanches. I liked the scene at your daughter's soccer game where your father is basically standing up to every other parent there saying, these kids should not be heading the soccer ball at, what were they, 8 years old?
Yes.
Obviously, they shouldn't have been doing it. It's like, I don't think they're even allowed to now. I think they've maybe made some rules that they're not allowed to head them at that young an age. But he didn't care what they thought. He was, and it was embarrassing to you, but he was right.
Exactly. And that was the paradox of my father. He was incredibly embarrassed. He was ostracizing me by being there with me. And he did not care about social norms or social structures. He didn't care if his granddaughter wasn't going to get invited to birthday parties or Halloween fairs anymore. He didn't want the kids to head the balls. And he told the parents, you know, you better not, you know, pay your kids to do headers. You better save that money because they're going to need tutors. I mean, that's the kind of person he was. And it was tough. It's hard to live with someone. He had social awareness, but he just didn't care.
Mm, well, after what he saw.
Right. His experience was different.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that if we can understand that other people have different experiences. And that was the healing with my children. Once they read the book, they realized, oh, Mom had a different experience than we had. And no wonder she parents us in this way. Mm. And they have told me, I didn't have your experience. And I try so hard to appreciate the experience that they have had and to not impose my experience onto them, which is a daily struggle, I've got to say.
I think it is for everyone, but most of us don't even think about it.
Right.
We don't think about that we're doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
My daughters are all adventurous travelers, and I worry like crazy for them. And I want to warn them and protect them. And I want to instill fear in them, but I don't. You know, I don't want them to live in fear, but I want them to understand that they might not be safe, but I have to understand their experience is different than mine. They weren't raised in fear like I was.
Right, right.
And it is, like you said, a lot of people don't think about that. And I have to remind myself daily.
Well, you know, it just made me think, like, with my mom, my mother, and every time I travel, she's so worried about me the whole time I'm gone. And she's like, everything's so dangerous. And I'm like, well, you know, the U.S. is probably, especially if I'm going overseas, the U.S. is probably more dangerous than any place I'm going to, you know, when you get right down. But she can't, you know, she kind of understands that, but it's still very hard for her. And I need to think back and see what was it in her experience. You know, she grew up during World War II. She was a child during World War II. And so maybe Europe to her seems like a scary place because that's what she learned about as a child.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard to think, oh, yeah, someone else has such a totally different experience than I do. And they're acting this way because of that experience.
And probably almost anyone who we might think of as bad or awful or evil is acting out of some prior experience that they've had that we don't understand. But then you have to get to the point where, okay, but when do you excuse people because they can't really help it because of the past? And when do you hold them accountable? When are they accountable for their own actions now?
And I think we can hold people accountable. I think we need to. But I think we also need to understand them more than forgiving or excusing. It's about understanding.
Yeah.
And that is my big hope with this book, is that people will start talking to each other in a deeper way, a way where they can understand another person's experience rather than being offended by it, but to really try to fully understand that person has that different experience. Doesn't excuse it, doesn't excuse their behavior, but I think understanding that behavior is better for both people. It certainly was so much better, so much easier for me to live once I could understand my father.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, he knew you were writing about his war experiences. Did he also know you were writing about your childhood?
Yes, he did.
Did he read any of that part?
Yes, he did.
And how did he respond to that?
He said, you know, Becky, do what you've got to do. Do, you know, I have my story and you have yours. Tell it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt that was very generous of him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you decided what you were going to make a memoir out of this, did it become your full-time occupation at that point, or were you fitting it in around a day job?
I worked in the publishing industry for over 20 years, and I left publishing right around the time that my father started talking to me about this. So I was raising kids and writing. So it was my day job. I wrote for about 4 hours a day, every day.
Wow. And did you write longhand or on a computer?
On a computer.
Yeah. And you said you did many, many drafts.
Yes.
At what point did you decide, okay, this is good enough to start sending out? I mean, how did you know? How did you know when you were at that point?
I am a big advocate of writing groups and writing mentorship. And I had been in a writing group with a writing mentor for quite a while. And I couldn't take the story any further. And the writing group couldn't take it any further. And my mentor, you know, she couldn't either. it was as good as we could get it. And I had learned to write in scene. I had studied novel writing because I really wanted the memoir to be felt lived and not told.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, that was important to me. Yeah. Because I think that's what really readers respond to that.
Absolutely.
I think that's what really grabs them and carries them along the story is scene writing.
Yeah. And also your just use of words, your descriptive, the way you describe things, the metaphors and analogies that you use is just very original and, you know, not cliche at all and very intriguing.
No cliche. That's another one. No cliche. Yeah. We didn't allow that in our writing group.
Yep.
Not even two words together that might be cliche, because I think we don't read cliche. We overread it.
Yes. Yeah. Now, when you started sending out, did you find immediate success or?
Well, immediate is relative, isn't it? I was very fortunate and I found my agent. I sent out to about 7 agents and within 30 days I had signed with her.
And were these people that you knew from your work in publishing?
They were not.
They were not. Oh, wow.
No, they were not.
Yeah. Okay. And
I knew publishing well enough to know I wanted an agent who focused on this genre or who understood this genre well.
Yeah.
So,
did the agent suggest any changes to your manuscript?
She was an editor for 20 years. So she had many bestsellers to her name and she suggested some, not major overhauls, but some.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it was an editor, a developmental editor after I got my agent who suggested the change in structure.
Right. Which I think probably took some time to do. Did it take some time to pull that out and unbraid it, or was it just moving chapters around?
Well, time is also relative. I would say it took me about 9 months. So it's happened. It was actually quite easy. It was fun. It was fun to do.
That is great. And you know what? We're out of time. Speaking of time being relative. So thank you so much for being with us. We always close with a quote. And I found one from Tom Glenn, who's a writer who writes about, who had post-traumatic stress injury himself and writes about it. Post-traumatic stress injury isn't a disease. It's a wound to the soul that never heals.
So beautiful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us today, Becky. And,
thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Look forward to seeing what you write next.
Thank you.